The Rosenbeck Museum and Library presents Sherlock Mondays, hosted by Edward G. Pettit.
Welcome to Sherlock Mondays, everyone. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we're on a biblio venture with the stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is episode 15, The Adventure of the Barrel Coronet. And joining me as co-host is Anastasia Klimchinskaya. Hi, Anastasia. Welcome back.
Hi, Ed. It's great to be back. It feels like it's been forever since I've been on.
It has. It's been literally forever. we had a break and everything. So I'm very happy to have you here for this. And we will catch up on your travels in just a second. Because what we'll be doing after that on Sherlock Mondays is we dissect Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about the world's first consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, and his able assistant, Dr. John Watson, in a kind of conversational annotation. If you're watching live right now, I'd ask you to please like and subscribe these videos and have fun in the live chat. If you're watching the recording, also please like and subscribe. Sherlock Mondays is also an audio podcast, and thank you to all of our podcast listeners. And I want to welcome any new viewers to the show, just because I've been seeing an uptick in registrations really over the past several weeks now. So I hope you enjoy the show. You can watch all the past episodes on our YouTube channel. But, you know, the nice thing about Sherlock Mondays is we're doing a story a week. You don't have to catch up. Just read the story for this week and join in the fun. I would also ask you all to please consider making a donation to the Rosenbeck. If you've already donated, thank you so much, or joined as a member in the last few months. That's really how we get to do this show, because of your support for the Rosenbeck. So if you've not already donated or become a member, I invite you to do so. And thank you. Before we get to where in the world is Anastasia Klimchinskaya, what at least I'm drinking tonight.
Well, to begin with, she's on your glass.
There you go. You are. You're on my glass. Where are you? You're right here. Yes. Right there on my glass from our Sundays with Frankenstein days. Every episode features a Sherlock tale designed by one of our co-hosts, Mary Alcaro, who will be with me on the next episode. You can find the recipes in the YouTube description for the episode, and I send out the recipe via email every week for those who are registered for the show. You can register at Sherlock Monday's homepage on rosenbeck.org. For this week, it's The Banker's Dilemma. And it's bourbon, Campari, splash of soda water, lemon juice. And I made a garnish. This was Mary's idea to do this, of cherries and a twisted up lemon rind. This is the broken part of the barrel coronet right here. So in my drink.
That's delightful.
And it is an absolutely delicious drink. I like a bourbon or whiskey drink. And Campari, I'm all over Campari. And I go through so many bottles of Campari. Mm. Well, Anastasia, you are a world traveler, as you have been your entire life. But it seems like lately you've really been traveling.
Yeah, there's that line about Sherlock Holmes being a bohemian soul, and I've always connected with that line. I do love to travel. I've been to quite a few countries since we talked. I was in France in a little town called Amiens, about an hour outside of Paris, doing some research on Jules Verne, and took some side trips from there to the Netherlands, to Slovenia, and also spent a week in Paris, which of course is one of my favorite cities, where I actually got together with some Sherlockians. When I studied in Paris as an undergraduate, I was part of a Sherlock Holmes Society in Paris, and they meet every second Wednesday in a little Irish pub, just as they did 10 years ago. So I kind of got to spend a meeting with the group that I was part of, 10, 12 years ago, which is delightful.
Wow. Are they a science society?
You know, I believe they are. It's Le Cercle Olvésien de Paris, so the Holmésian Circle of Paris, and they've been around for quite a while.
Nice. So you weren't just going visiting Emily in Paris sites. You were actually...
Oh goodness. You know, that wasn't on plan. My dad just looked at the map and said, hey, this is around the corner. For those who don't follow me on Facebook, we got to the place and there was this giant graffiti that said, Emily not welcome. So you can tell...
That's the people that live there are tired of the tour.
Well, I mean, somebody who was a local wrote it in very, very large letters on kind of the wall that Emily not welcome. So you can tell at least how some Parisians feel about it.
And did you have something you're not going to reveal today, but there was another Sherlockian connection?
Not today. There is, in fact, a Sherlockian connection. It has to do with a story called The Bruce Partington Plans, which I believe I'll be on for in a few weeks or a few months. So there is a little Parisian connection with that tale. So I'm just going to tease that and say that I saw that connection, and I'll talk about it when I'm on for that show.
Great. All righty. Little extra bonus content. So
indeed.
We will also, you and I and many others, will also be attending the Baker Street Irregular Weekend in New York City this weekend, Wednesday through Sunday. It's January 10th to the 14th, if you watch the replay of this, and you may have missed it. All kinds of Sherlockian events, and it's, of course, the place where people get inducted into the Baker Street Irregulars, as you have been and gotten your name, the old Russian woman.
The old Russian woman.
And it'll be a lot of fun, and I can't wait to. And I'm going to get to meet some other. I've never attended all the years that I've been in the Sherlock, and I'm close. I'm in Philadelphia. I've never gotten around to it. I think I was close to going one year, and then. I went to the Moby Dick Marathon reading in New Bedford instead. And then I think I was kind of close to going in the year that COVID hit. I think I was going to go that year and obviously couldn't. So. But this year it'll be perfect. If there's anybody there who's watching the show and if you're going and you see me there, please don't hesitate to say hello, especially if I've never met you. I love to meet.
Right, likewise.
Yeah.
And I will say the dinner is by invitation only, the big BSI dinner on Friday, but all the other events are open to the public, though I think many of them are sold out by now, but many are open to the public. So if you're hesitating, you know, you don't need a formal invitation to any of them.
Yeah. And I've signed up for a few things, but, you know, I know that. And it's also just Sherlockians hanging out in between everything. So,
oh, yeah, there's an after party. We stay up every night until 2:21 a.m. We can't leave before 2:21. It's not allowed. If you do, you get penalized.
I will feel right at home. That is completely OK with me. Good. All righty. Well, I look forward to that. But let us get on with our story for this episode. We have shared.
I have that edition I talked about last time. You know, I still have that edition that I got when I was 12. I'm using it again.
Good. We have shared the PDF of the facsimile of the adventure of the Barrel Coronet as it was originally published in the May 1892 issue of the Strand magazine. You can download that on the Rosenbeck's Sherlock Mondays page. And just so everybody knows, the last episode we did the Blue Carbuncle, and we went out of order. We had moved the Blue Carbuncle to talk about that around when we would be on streaming live near Christmas. So because that's a Christmas story. So the Barrel Coronet, the story that it followed, would have been the Noble Bachelor. So readers have just read the month previous, they read about the rich American Hattie Doran who dumped the dignified drip Lord Robert St. Simon. That's what people had just read. And now this is the next story, The Barrel Coronet, May 1892. It's actually published in which I read, it was published in more than 10 American newspapers in April.
Oh, wow.
And then The Strand in May in England and in America. One of the reasons Doyle was doing this, that he has to sell the rights separately, is because the international copyright law has just changed, but it's still a little bit Wild West. And Doyle wants to make sure that he gets, like, if he just publishes it in England first, then copies could soon be available anywhere in the United States. And he's afraid of that because that's what had always happened with, you know, people violating copyrights. But now there is a copyright in place. But what he does to make sure that he can get, you know, he can also be, you know, paid for his work is that he sells it to a bunch of newspapers first. And they do have the right to run it even before The Strand. And they're starting to do that. It was published in the Philadelphia Inquirer here in Philadelphia. Under the same title. Sometimes they change the titles over two different Sundays in April. And this is what it looked like as it came out in that Sunday edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Just big spread here. This is Sunday morning, wow. April 17. And it's not even the lead story. And there's not even an illustration for it in the first week. It says The Adventure of the Barrel Coronet, a detective story of unusual interest in which Sherlock Holmes figures. I mean, it's just an odd way to do the titling, but there's subtitle. And it's just a few columns here. And then it continued the next month. This is Sunday morning, April 24. And now it's titled The Barrel Coronet, the story of the surprising adventure through which it passed. The very precise grammar of a subtitle here. And there is an illustration here, and this comes later in the story, but we'll share it here. And this is when Holmes is demonstrating with Holder and Watson that you can't really break this thing easily. And this is Holmes. And he's got a mustache. And several of the other illustrators...
He looks like Watson.
You'd think that was, and especially because, you know, Watson's here with this Inverness cape here. This is Holmes bending it up or trying to bend it with a mustache. This is an artist by the name of F.C. Drake. We know this is Holmes, too, because that's what happens in the story. But also there was another illustration Drake did in another magazine, which it's clearly this is the Holmes figure that he's got with the mustache. And I just find it odd that several illustrators who were in Paget were giving Holmes mustaches, including, I think, the first illustrator of Sherlock in, you know, for Study in Scarlet had done that. So his father, Doyle's father, gave Holmes a mustache in his illustrations for Study in Scarlet. So very interesting that, you know, these... I'll actually post this on the website along with the PDF of the Strand facsimile that I always put up there. I'll also post this as well so people can look at it. This is Adventure 11. We're just about to round out the 12 adventures that Doyle has promised the Strand. And it begins with Watson looking out the window of Baker Street. And I had a note to myself here in my notes. How many stories so far do they look out the window? And then I forgot to tally them up. I meant to tally them up because it's odd that this is like a trope of the stories. This is part of his formula, right? That at some point they look out the window, usually and towards the beginning of a story.
Yeah, they're in Baker Street, they're in their rooms, they're enjoying breakfast or tea and maybe having a little thematic discussion that becomes relevant to the story, and then a client comes to visit. Although, as we've talked about, sometimes Doyle does break that formula just for a little bit of excitement.
He shakes up the formula a lot. He's always trying to play with this form to make it more interesting each week, especially as we're seeing with all these early stories. But this kind of looking out the window of Baker Street, it's almost like a meta moment for me, that these characters, and this is their view of the world, and we're kind of brought into them to see their view of the world. And this time they're looking out, and what they see is what they think is a madman coming along. Skipping along, he's 50, tall, portly, imposing, with a massive, strongly marked face and a commanding figure. But his actions were in absurd contrast to the dignity of his dress and features. He's jerking his hands up and down, waggling his head, writhing his face into the most extraordinary contortions. I mean, this seems really weird. This almost seems like a Dickensian kind of, you know, description here of the way people behave.
Well, and again, it's one of those things where it's that Victorian obsession with class and propriety and how you look. And if you look at somebody, you should be able to tell what class they belong to, and then they should behave according to that class. And if somebody doesn't fit into that sort of the box that they're supposed to fit into, then that's, as Watson says, quite literally extraordinary, out of the ordinary, abnormal. And it's not just that he's acting strange, it's that he is clearly well-dressed, clearly of a respectable class, apparently, respectable middle class. But he is not behaving like a respectable middle class. And that's uncomfortable. That's discomforting.
But Holmes loves it. It says he's rubbing his hands. I believe he is coming here. Like, Holmes loves this, because like, this is a weird guy, and this is going to be, you know, this is going to work out well for us.
Yeah, Holmes loves finding the extraordinary in the dull commonplaces of existence, to quote A Case of Identity.
And then he gets even stranger, because he comes in and he looks, first he has a look of grief and despair in his eyes. And it says that our smiles were turned in an instant to horror and pity. And he's pulling his hair. And then he says to bang his head against the wall. And they have to grab him and put him in a chair. Now, for whatever effect Doyle is trying to do here, to say that, like, oh, it's not funny now, I don't know. This almost seems like the beginning of a Monty Python skit. And it's funny. This Definitely, is slapstick. Yeah. This is what happens in slapstick comedy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole stories are incredibly funny. I think maybe sometimes people think, because Sherlock Holmes is such a rational figure, that maybe there isn't that much humor in the stories, that he's just kind of cold and logical. But no, the stories are incredibly funny, moments like this, but also moments when Sherlock Holmes, you know, insists how logical and rational and unemotional he is, and like two pages later he is getting incredibly dramatic and theatrical. It's like, are you sure that you're not emotional sometimes?
And not only that, but like this behavior itself seems very theatrical. This seems very stagey, the way somebody I don't know. Do people really bang their head against the wall like this when they're upset about something? You know, I mean, I don't recall an incident of it happening, but it seems like something, like, this is the way people who are grieving behave on stage in art. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's, you know, got going on. That's why I think I've still been. What I'm shocked is that Dr. Watson doesn't give him brandy. Quick, brandy, man. No brandy? This guy clearly needs a brandy.
Tragic.
So instead, Holmes, calms him down, patted his hand, chatted with him in the easy, soothing tones which he knew so well how to employ. I mean, the kind of thing that we've mentioned this more than once in this series, how Holmes showing, you know, sympathy or empathy for people in distress is something that he does know how to do and does well.
Mm-hmm. Or at least he seems to get better at doing as the stories go on. Certainly the Holmes in Study in Scarlet would likely have struggled with that. But, you know, as the stories go on, he seems to become more empathetic.
Yeah. I mean, it's he has that side of him where he's brusque and he, you know, brushes people off. So far, it seems that he's only rude to people who kind of deserve it so far in the stories, like the King of Bohemia. You know, Holmes is rude to him, and I think it's, well, and because the king deserves it, he's being pompous, and Holmes, you know, doesn't respond to that. But with people truly in distress, he's absolutely, you know, comforting to them always. So, well, we find out that this is a big deal here. It is the his trouble is going to be is a public disgrace, a private affliction, and the nobles in the land may suffer. So this is a...
Well, that's just the worst.
Quite a big case he's bringing up here. So, and notice, no crime. He doesn't say, like, there was a terrible crime that happened. No, it's public disgrace, private affliction, and nobility may suffer. So that's the, you know, and that, I think, the way that is encapsulated there will have a great bearing on the end of this tale in how Holmes winds up meeting out justice or doesn't meet out justice at the end of the story, because I want to point that out now, because this is how it begins. It doesn't begin like somebody stole something and we have to catch them. It begins.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He was recommended by the police. It's Alexander Holder, as we know, and he's a banker. The second largest private banking concern in the city of London. And then he gives a little like banking for dummies paragraph here. It is well known to you that banks do this. And one of the most lucrative means of laying out money is in the shape of loans where, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, I feel like we're getting a little, what's that thing that they call that in science fiction where they drop those
techno babble.
Yeah. It's like a little techno babble, but it's banking babble here just to make sure people understand what happened here in this situation.
Well, even before we get to that, I just wanted to emphasize the brief mention of the underground, the London Underground, the tube, which, you know, doesn't actually have any bearing on the story. I was actually hoping it would, you know, I was hoping the fact that everything is snowed in and you can only take the underground would end up having some kind of bearing. But no, it's just, I love public transit. I especially love the metro. So whenever I see a mention of the underground in a 19th century novel, I just get very excited.
I'm glad you brought it up. It was brought up in another earlier story, was it not? And now I'm trying to remember what story it was. And I can't remember. And the key is that it was mentioned, but it doesn't ever say Holmes is on the underground. But I think he is on the underground in this, but we'll get to it. We'll get to it.
So actually, one of the Sherlockians I had the lovely gathering with in Paris pointed out to me, and I think this is correct, that the underground gets mentioned quite often in the stories, but Holmes himself only takes it once. I'll have to double check in what story.
It may say that he takes it once. Here it doesn't say, but I think he actually does, but even though he doesn't say specifically the underground. But we'll get to that. That's in a minute. So I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you. That's how he has arrived. He had to take the underground and then run on foot, and that's his, you know, the way he's gotten there. And then he gives this, you know, he tells, you know, this is what I do for a living in the bank. And then one of the highest, noblest, most exalted names in England has brought, once alone, and brings this barrel coronet. A coronet, it's a crown, it's a little crown. It's a coronet, not a crown. And it has these barrels in it. And that's a security for the loan. But he really hints at who it is, but doesn't say who it is. And now Doyle's not going to write a story and name a real life nobleman, because that would, you know, I mean, not be, you know, that's not a good idea. I mean, it's not illegal necessarily, but it certainly wouldn't be, you know, proper to put a real person in a fictional story.
I mean, certainly it, you know, outside of the legality and the concerns over libel or whatnot, it's just the fact that if you're an upstanding Victorian gentleman, you don't do that to your nobility.
But is it the Prince of Wales? And does everybody just think that it's the Prince of Wales?
Who knows? But then, you know, the other interesting thing kind of playing through this story is, as we've mentioned, and we'll get to this later, so much of it hinges on sort of reputation. And, you know, the very act of Watson penning the story means that all of this kind of dirty laundry actually comes out at one point or another. So we have to presume that he's writing the story, I think, many, many years after it actually happened.
It's a name which a household the world over the earth knows, and one of the highest, noblest, most exalted names in England. I mean, it really seems like he's hinting at the Prince of Wales, not just another duke or earl or something like that in the land. And it would make sense in the way it kind of goes about, because this nobleman wants the loan, and then he tells Holder that, well, I don't want to ask my friends. Of course, I could ask anyone for this money, but I don't want to do that. And the Prince of Wales himself had a reputation for being a bit of a playboy, for getting around. People knew he was a partier. He will later become king. He'll become Edward the VII when Queen Victoria dies. But he does have a reputation. And it seems like that's the kind of nobleman who's going to have to go to a bank to get money. For why does he need 50,000? Is it 50,000? 50,000 pounds that fast? It seems.
The whole setup. You mentioned that there are scenes here that feel a little bit like a play, like a drama. I mean, that whole setup feels maybe almost a little bit melodramatic. I mean, the sums are so huge. The timing is just so, just a few days. It's so high stakes. It's so kind of exaggerated.
It's the kind of thing that we see more often in crime stories about con artists now. They're like, oh, you need this money really fast. Well, if you just give me this security, then don't worry, you'll get it back. And then the security winds up being, fraudulent or something. But it's not in this.
That's the other, way I thought the story might maybe go back when I read it.
It's not a real barrel coronet. So.
I mean, he doesn't even check that it's the real thing. He just accepts it. I guess you don't question the Prince of Wales.
Yeah, it's clearly this nobleman he's not going to question. And so he has to do it. He even says the nobleman not only would prefer not to take it to someone else, but he doesn't even know what, like, he's like, I don't know anything about this banking stuff, so here, just take this coronet and give me the money, because why would he know anything about money? That's a dirty business kind of thing. He's a nobleman. He doesn't have to concern himself with that.
Presumably to rule a country, you have to understand something about how money works, but he knows
how to spend it. That's what he knows how.
Unimportant.
It's got 39 enormous barrels and this gold, filigree chase, gold chasing all around it to keep it together. Barrels, if anyone don't know, are a gemstone that's usually green. So we have to assume these are green gems. They're emeralds is what they are. And emerald is literally green. And it's an invaluable piece. It's like he's brought him like part of the crown jewel collection or something, it seems.
Could he have picked something, less?
Something, yeah.
Okay.
That would raise so many red flags or tempt people, yeah. So, of course, it'll be a scandal if anything would happen to it, but I'm going to leave it with you anyway. This is why it all seems so suspicious. It's not. It's just, it seems so suspicious, somebody leaving this kind of something so valuable to him. And then, this is the weirdest thing, that Holder thinks, bankers' safes in a bank have been robbed, so I better take it home with me.
Just, you know, take it on the underground. No pickpockets there.
Yeah. As if, you know, as if on his person is any safer, or just having it home is any safer. Now, that gets pointed out later by his son. Like, are you kidding me, Dad? You put it in where? Your dresser drawers? What? But clearly, like, the safest place for this would have been an actual safe. In a building.
Yeah. The kind that banks sometimes have, I hear.
How about, hey, guard, stand in my room all night outside the safe. Don't leave.
Yeah. Wow. You do have to wonder how this bank got to be, you know, the largest and the most important one in London.
Clearly, he might be a banker. He is not in charge of security. So they'd certainly need, you know, to refresh their security policies. This guy's just taking the securities home with him to be safer. So, then he's telling the story to Holmes, and he gets home, and Holmes, you know, immediately he's like, well, you know, let me tell you about the household I'm living in. He's got a Lucy Parr, the second waiting maid. Is pretty and has attracted admirers. So he's pointing these clues out. And now, as mystery readers, as Doyle's developing this genre that's been going on for a few decades, but Doyle's one of the ones that really develops the how to read these kinds of stories. Readers need to be like, oh, this might be a clue. You know, all the details that are coming out here. He's a widower. He has an only son who's disappointing. Not just a disappointment, a grievous disappointment. He has to, you know. But it's all his own fault because he spoiled him. Wild and wayward. He's a member of an aristocratic club. And under the influence of Sir George Burnwell. This reminds me of the whole scenario of Dorian Gray.
Absolutely. I had that thought when reading as well, with Dorian Gray, sort of this very impressionable youth who is corrupted by an aristocrat named Lord Henry, who is essentially tempts him into a life of vice.
This is in a couple Dickens novels too, where these, you know, aristocrats and he's prey, Arthur. He's rich. And his father is, you know, rich. Well, he's not rich. His father is rich and he has access to money. So he's, you know, prey to these, you know, people who may be a sir, Sir George Burnwell, but he certainly, you know, certainly doesn't have an income probably.
And I mean, we've seen this in stories before. I mean, this was a big Victorian anxiety of noblemen just kind of drinking or smoking through their money or losing it at gambling or any number of vices. I think the last story I was on for was The Man with the Twisted Lip, which starts with, you know, a man who's essentially squandered his fortune in the opium den. So this is just something that's so common in Victorian literature. You see these young noblemen from good families who are just squandering their fortunes because they can. There's really no mechanism in place to stop them from doing it.
And because of their title, they get to still maintain their status in society. And then can go out and, you know, get people to kind of finance their lifestyle or find a rich girl to marry and, you know, take her money. Looking at you, Lord Robert St. Simon. There's also another person in the household, and that's Holder's niece, Mary, who is a sunbeam in my house, sweet, loving, beautiful, a wonderful manager and housekeeper, yet as tender and quiet as a woman could be. I mean, this is that whole angel in the house.
I mean, she's a perfect Victorian cliche.
Yeah.
It just, you know, you kind of, you read this and you think, okay, so you've got the son of the house who's squandering all the money and living a life of vice, and you've got the, you know, perfect angel of the house, so is this perfect woman. And you think, well, who is the culprit going to be? Is it going to be the most kind of obvious person, or is Doyle going to sort of switch that up, or is he going to kind of do a double bluff, or what's he going to do with those character types?
Also, and he has well, we're not going to keep a secret, like, because I like to look at what Mary does and what that really means, because we know the ending of the story. And that the first thing is that Arthur, Holder's son Arthur, wants to marry her, but she has said no. And for modern readers, it's not weird that the cousins would marry. So some people still find that weird. It's still in the 19th century, it's frequent that cousins will marry. It's not an unusual thing at all. It doesn't really become unusual until the 20th century. Basically, when you're interested in someone romantically, there's no such thing as dating. So once you're interested, you're making a declaration. So you need to know who this person is and know all about them. And with cousins, there's a great security there, because I know your family. I know exactly who you are. Now, it's also another thing for people with money, that it keeps money and land and things like that within a family contained. But it's that bigger thing, I think, also, that you understand who these people are. You may already know them and have already developed a friendship with them because you've known them throughout your life. So it's easier then to move on in that day and age, you know, to being married. But because we know the end of this story, because we know what happened, that Mary is... This is the whole setup. And I love the way Doyle sets this up, because he sets her up as, I don't think it's suspicious that he set her up as the paragon, the Victorian ideal of womanhood, just because that's in so many stories and novels at the time. It just seems like, oh yeah, she's the nice daughter, or the nice niece in this case. And he's completely setting us up. And I don't think we ever get a hint that she's the one that's, you know, bad in the story. Do we? I mean, well, if we do get one, let me know, because I don't think there's ever a hint. And just her saying no to him, I don't think is a hint. It's just, oh, she's being modest.
I mean, it depends on how suspicious a reader you are and how many detective stories you've read, which, again, since this is a genre that's just developing, you haven't read that many, not that many exist. But it's so interesting to see, again, Doyle setting up these kind of perfect Victorian types in order to just kind of subvert them. I find that so interesting from the point of view of within a broader landscape of Victorian literature.
This is a story that absolutely subverts conventions, that absolutely, you know, plays with that, you know, undermines that idea of this is what, you know, respectable middle-class Victorian society should be. And let me show you, you know, how it can go wrong. So, because she says no to him, because she's already in love with Sir George Burnwell. That's why she says no. And then he's telling the story to Holmes still. And this is where his son Arthur says, you've locked it up in your bureau. Are you kidding me? Like, I could break into that with, you know, any old key, as I did when I was a little kid. And then he says, look here, Dad, can you let me have 200 pounds?
It's like, could you be any more suspicious? You know, you say, hey, I can break into your bureau. And then, you know, 2 seconds later, oh, by the way, could I have 200 pounds?
200 pounds. So, and that's not a little bit of money. That's, you know, that's a lot of money. that he's asking for. Was it gambling debts? Is that what it is that he's got to, he's got to pay off?
He won't be let back in the club, which of course,
yes,
a disgrace.
And his father's like, good. I don't want you going to that club. I don't want you going to a club where you're going to lose $200. So, or £200. So, they have this angry exchange. And, but just to remember that just before then, that exchange, when Holder's telling Holmes a story, he's saying that, like, I told my son and my niece where the coronet was. So they're both in the room with him. They're the only ones that know where this thing is. Mary is seen by Holder at the window in the hall, which she closed and fastened as I approached. And this was actually where the second part of the crime actually happened, that she had taken this is where she has just given the coronet to Sir George Burnwell and just missed getting caught by, her uncle here. And she quickly covers up for it, right? This is what,
and so perfectly too.
She is, and she's not just like in love and I'm being deceived by this guy. She's also, I think, a bit nefarious here and how quick she is to say, did you give Lucy the maid leave to go out tonight? Like, it's all about, she's already putting the blame on the maid, that, making sure that this is who gets blamed for this when it is discovered.
Well, and of course it's easier to suspect the maid than his niece, because a maid, of a lower class and therefore, character wise, of course, more suspicious. Why wouldn't you suspect the maid?
Just go right to prison after I handed off the coronet to my lover here. So, mm-hmm. Holder then goes up. Well, here's a sound in the night, and he comes out and he finds that his son Arthur, bending the coronet, in the room. He's been caught with it in his hands, and they have, you villain, you thief. And then Arthur is like, what? And he notices that one of the gold corners with three of the barrels is missing. So it has been, a piece has been broken off. And he asks them where they are, and Arthur's like, I'm not going to, tell you where they are. It's insulting that you would accuse me of being a thief. Come on, Arthur, dude, you're standing there with a coronet in your hand. So it's likely that he's going to think you're the thief, right? But this is a whole father-son angry dynamic that they've been playing out. And so it's very believable that they can't see eye to eye here. But Arthur knows what's going on already, and he's just hiding the fact that, he can't betray Mary. And then when she comes in,
he's protecting Mary because he's in love with her, even though, an argument could be made that she does not deserve it.
Well, it's interesting. It says, Mary was the first to rush into my room, and at the sight of the coronet and of Arthur's face, she read the whole story and with a scream fell down senseless on the ground. So what happens is she comes into the room and she looks, and Arthur's holding the coronet, which she has just given to Burnwell, and she's thinking, oh my God, I just got caught, and she faints. I think probably legitimately. I don't think this is one of those like, oh, I better faint to get out of this situation. I think she's probably that upset that she got caught. But they misinterpret it. They see her fainting clearly as this great trouble. Oh my God, she saw Arthur with it, but she knows that Arthur didn't take it because she did, clearly. And then Arthur asks one thing. He says, he's like, don't arrest me yet. Give me 5 minutes. Give me 5 minutes to go outside, which is because he knows what happened and there's a piece broken off and he thinks he could search the grounds for the piece of the coronet. So I like how Doyle is, and this doesn't happen in every story, because frequently we get stories where Holmes does an investigation and finds things, and then Holmes lists all the things afterwards. But we don't get this kind of detail. We haven't gotten this kind of detail yet in a story where the story can be read two ways. The first time you read it, you don't see all these things happening. And then once you know the solution, you go through it again, you see how Doyle has planted everything all along. And everything has a different interpretation. And that's, I think this is a story that has moved Doyle forward in writing mystery stories.
Mm-hmm.
So he's told this story to Holmes. He has some questions. And before we get to those questions, let me take a moment to thank you all for watching this episode. As a nonprofit organization, the Rosenbach Museum and Library depends on the generosity of friends and supporters like you to keep programs like this free and accessible to hundreds of fellow Sherlockians worldwide. Hopefully some of those Sherlockians I'll meet this coming weekend at the Baker Street Irregular Weekend. I hope you will consider supporting the Rosenbach and Sherlock Mondays by donation, which you can do so at our website, or by becoming a member. Membership gives you free museum admission, discounts on programs and courses, and exclusive invitations to member-only events. You can learn more about how to become a member on our website. And also, we have, I should mention, because we have some great programs and courses coming up, in-person programs at the Rosenbach, like our Burns Night, which is happening on January 25th. And we also have these great online courses. There is a Dracula course where, because the Rosenbach, we have the Bram Stoker's Notes for Dracula, the 100 or so various pages of research notes and early plot outlines and all the stuff that Bram Stoker was putting together as he was writing Dracula over 7 years. We have that in our collections. And so I'm teaching a course on Dracula and using those notes in the course. Every session that we meet, I'll share some things with you. So you can register to take an online Dracula course with me. There's also a weekly Joyce Ulysses class. Usually we have our Ulysses classes where they go monthly for 9 months and you read the whole novel. We're trying something different this time. It's an 18-week course leading right up to Bloomsday when we celebrate the events of that novel with a big outdoor festival at the Rosenbach. But there's an online course, 18 weeks of Ulysses, with a great artist named Robert Berry, who has been for many years creating a comic book of Ulysses. There's also a Robert Burns course online and an in-person Robert Burns seminar and an online Virginia Woolf course. A lot of great stuff to take this winter. Then there'll be more courses coming up in the spring, but it's one of the things that we do with the Rosenbach to really help you engage with our collections and the things that we have are running these reading courses, and they're a lot of fun, and I strongly recommend them. And if you're a Rosenbach member, you get a discount. You get a 10% discount on courses. You get other discounts on other programs. And you can be a member and join, or you don't have to be a member and you could take a course. That's all fine too. You can also find us on our Facebook group page, Sherlock Mondays, for lots more Sherlockian info, news, links, conversation, and fun. We have an audio podcast too. And that's all I'm going to say for today. So there's so much I could I got to keep the plugs simple, but I really wanted to plug the courses tonight because courses will start soon in February and there's a lot of great ones. So alrighty, back to the story. Have you ever taken a course at the Rosenbach, Anastasia?
Me? Yeah. Several.
Because you've taught them.
I have taught a few. I've taken a couple with Mary and Lauren, the co-host
for
Frankenstein. Yeah.
Yeah.
They've done a couple of Gothic classes. I've taken both, and they were absolutely excellent. So, you know, I can't say enough good things about them.
And you taught a great Jules Verne class for us, which I love.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was a delight to teach.
All righty. Now back to the story. Holder's telling him what all this that has happened here. And then Holmes, of course, has questions. The son's arrested. You know, that's what Holder tells him. And then Holmes has questions. And it's interesting, his questions, because Holmes always does this with clients. He'll have some clarifying questions. There's points that he wants to know. And they're also points that Doyle wants us to be aware of. You know, Holmes wants to know.
I'm just stunned by how well Holder has just laid out all of the key points and all of the characters. It's like you're filling out, you know, one of those Clue cards. By the way, I don't think I've ever actually played Clue, but that's
really wow.
I've seen the movie, but I don't think I've ever actually played Clue. But I get the concept. But it's like you're filling out a Clue card, and Holder's just going through all of the kind of people in the house and saying where they were and what they were doing. And it's just so neat. And he remembers everything so perfectly well. And it's just, witness statements are rarely that accurate.
Yeah. And Holmes still has questions, though. He wants to know if they receive much company. He wants to know, and then he says, just said Sir George Burnwell. And do you go out much? He says, just Arthur does. Mary stays home. And then Holmes clues in on Mary. That's unusual. Mm-hmm. And then, well, she's, you know, young. She's only 24. And Holmes is like, well, this seems to have shocked her. And she's like, oh, she's even more affected than I am. I mean, this is Holmes' real... Holmes has already realized the only thing he needs to know, that only the thief had to know the coronet was in the bureau. And so it has to be Arthur or Mary or a servant overhearing it. And so he's trying to pin down who released this information. And Holmes already, then Holmes says that, you know, he doesn't think that Arthur did it. I mean, just his behavior itself doesn't seem like he did it, you know. I mean, why wouldn't he lie? Why would he, you know, why would he just not say anything and lie instead? Why is he standing there bending it if he stole them and then brought it back? Like, none of it makes any sense for someone who has stolen the coronet and then tried to plant it back after taking a piece off of it or something. So it doesn't make any sense to Holmes. It shouldn't make any sense to an actual investigator. and the kind of simplicity for Holder is that, like, well, I caught my son with it in his hands, so it must be his. So he must be guilty. That's the kind of thing that Holmes always doesn't think is the solution. Mm-hmm. And it isn't in these stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if it was the solution, there'd be no story.
Well, Watson falls for it. Well, of course. Then we get the Watson assessment, like, oh, I don't know, it must have been him. he can't imagine how, you know, it wouldn't be anybody else. But he says he has faith in Holmes' judgment, so he's going to hold off. And then they... Holmes sits and thinks for a bit, that thinking pose, chin upon the breast, hat drawn over his eyes, and in deep thought as they're heading out to, you know, his house. But it says, a short railway journey and a shorter walk brought us to Fairbank, the modest residence of the great financier. If they go back the same way that with Holder, that Holder came to them, well, then why aren't they should be on the underground, right? That's how Holder came. So this is where that short railway journey, it doesn't say underground, but it's still a train. It's still the railway. And it seems to me that this is actually Holmes, which we never picture. We never picture Holmes in a train underground and, you know, going down the steps.
Well, you don't.
Apparently some people do.
I look, like I said, I am a metro lover. And I was also just in Paris, which is known for its really good metro. So I'm a subway nerd. And the London metro, the London Underground, I think is, one of the oldest in the world. The first line was opened in something like 1867. You'd have to double check the date, but it's one of those symbols of modernity. The Victorians really thought of themselves as progressive and modern and sort of technologically and scientifically ahead of the curve. And they had all of these technologies that they thought proved it, things like the underground, the telegram, the post, their railway system. And so we see Holmes as this kind of scientific, rational figure, the symbol of Victorian modernity, who's using all of these technologies of modernity, who's taking the underground, who's sending telegrams, who's looking in the newspapers and their agony columns, and consulting all of that mass print culture. So it's just really exciting to me to see him taking the underground.
Nope. And later stories, he's on the telephone frequently. So,
absolutely.
People forget that
he drives an automobile, I think there's possibly electric light in one of the stories, if I'm not misremembering.
The kind of idea of Holmes stories is that it's always 1895, but yet, Doyle writes them, well into the, a couple decades into the 20th century. And so Holmes will do these kinds of things, but they're, we only picture Basil Rathbone doing them, not necessarily Sherlock.
Yeah. Doyle died in 1930, and the last stories were written in the 1920s, which is, the period when, say, The Great Gatsby is set, if that helps you kind of envision the level of technology we're at here.
Yeah.
That would be a great crossover, Sherlock Holmes and The Great Gatsby. he solves, I'd say spoiler alert, but this is also more than 100 years old. Spoiler alert, he's called in to figure out whether Gatsby really committed suicide or if he's floating downwards in the pool at the end, for nefarious reasons.
That's good. I like that.
I'm sure somebody has written it.
Question Nick Carraway. So find out what happened here. All righty.
That would be a fun one.
Well, in this case, when they get to Holder's house, Holmes does the whole, they go inside and Holmes is outside looking at footprints. This is the usual activity for Sherlock and how he investigates. Watson goes in the house and he meets Mary, who's, deadly pale. Her eyes were flushed with crying. Watson thinks, oh, she's so upset for her uncle, for her cousin Arthur. And she says, you've ordered Arthur to be liberated, haven't you? And because I'm sure he's innocent. Yeah, I'm sure he's innocent too, because you did it. she's like, take my word for it that he is innocent. Let the matter drop and say no more.
How do you know?
Well, I don't, but we know now that the story's over, and it's a great irony here now that you know the story.
Oh, no, I was saying to Mary, how do you know?
Yeah, how do you know that he's in? Well, because I took it. And the irony is that she is the ability to free Arthur by, coming clean. And so they tell her that Sherlock's outside investigating and that worries her. She says, the stable lane? She raised her dark eyebrows. What can he hope to find there? It reads differently the second time you read it. because she knows that, you know, Arthur must have gone out there and confronted Burnwell to take the coronet back. Holmes comes in and says, and he questions her kind of quickly, right? He says, "You heard nothing yourself last night?" And then she again blames, well, he asks about the maid, right? He says, "Oh, the maid has a sweetheart." She's like, "Oh, yes. Wait.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and she was the girl who waited in the drawing room and who may have heard Uncle's remarks about the coronet."
Yes, so she's literally throwing the maid under the bus here. She's like,
and must just have lying been through her teeth, yeah.
The maid must have, you know, heard this, and so go arrest the maid and let Arthur go, is basically what she's saying. Or maybe she could also think that, like, the maid didn't do it, so, like, it doesn't matter. Like, they're going to find out that she's innocent, too, because, of course, innocent people don't go to jail, right? That's, you know, not what she would consider, but that could clearly happen. And then she has a sweetheart, a green grocer. His name is Francis Prosper, and Holmes says, and he's...
I mean, you know, at least her sweetheart isn't above her station. At least there's that.
Yes, and he has a wooden leg, as Holmes says. Has Jonathan Small been freed from jail? Is Jonathan Small behind all this? Not that wooden leg.
No, see, I thought of John Silver from Stevenson's story. That was where my mind went, but
you thought it was a pirate. No, I just think of Jonathan Small when I'm doing, you know, Sherlock now. So but something when Holmes says this, she says something like fear sprung up in the lady's expressive black eyes. "Why, you are like a magician. How did you know that?" She smiled, but there was no answering smile in Holmes's thin, eager face. Boom. Like, on the reread, this is the moment Holmes is like, "Oh, it was you." Like, now I know it was you. Like, Holmes has realized this is the person who has done it. She's trying to blame somebody else. This is, you know, I've just got to figure out why she took it, how she took it, and all that, you know. So, but really, why? He knows how she took it. He has to figure out why.
Well, and also she's calling Holmes a magician again, which we've seen time and again. He kind of, he reads something that whoever thinks is allegedly, you know, how could he possibly know? He gets called a wizard, a magician, that sort of thing. It seems like magic, but no, it's just a magic trick.
There's a Paget illustration for this confrontation too. Let me share that. You can find this in the, I'll share this PDF on the Sherlock Mondays page for the Rosenbach, but here they are. Holmes is, you know, not smiling, looking at her. I mean, you can't tell. See, she's smiling here, but she's concerned. There's a look of concern. This is Holmes kind of confronting her.
The way he's considering her, the way that she's like a butterfly specimen pinned to a corkboard, and he's just studying her. Like, I love that kind of, the way Paget captures that kind of power imbalance between them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, very, he's got his one arm crossed and the one hand up to his head as if he's considering, how can I have you arrested and save the reputation of your uncle? You know, is in his head, but he still doesn't know why she's taking it. So he's got to figure that out. All righty. And now he continues his examination of the house. Of course, you know, the magnifying glass. He gets that out and this powerful magnifying lens and walks around looking at things. He looks at the windowsill where she had said where Holder had seen her with it open. And then they go up to the coronet in the room, and it's got a crooked, cracked edge where a corner holding three gems had been torn away. So might look something like this in my drink.
Ed, are you the thief?
No, I wouldn't steal.
So. Are you stealing the British crown jewels?
Secret, a secret love who I've given it to. Nope. And then Holmes demonstrates that, like, look, he just didn't break it off. Like, I can't even break it off. I'm Sherlock Holmes, and I can't break it off.
and we've had that story already, I think, where Holmes just sort of bends, or no, it's somebody who walks in and bends a poker, and then he just Beckham unbends band. It. Yes. So we know he is incredibly strong.
But I like how he says, I feel like give a little, but, you know, even I can't, you know, bend this. So an ordinary man could not do it. And we know Holmes is not an ordinary man. So it's still all dark. And he needs to figure this out. I'm sorry. That's what Holder says. And then and he says, what do you think? Holmes says to Mary, what do you think, Miss Holder? So he's still kind of, you know, questioning her in this.
Questioning her or playing with her?
Playing with her, teasing her, right? Letting her know that, like, he's teasing her.
At this point, I think he's just having some fun.
And giving her an opportunity to come clean. And, you know, she's not doing it. So, Holmes is going to clear it all up. He says, oh, I'll clear it up. Holder asks him where the gems are. And he says, I can't tell you yet. But he's like, come to my rooms tomorrow morning at Baker Street between 9 and 10, and I'll tell you.
This goes back to Sherlock Holmes being a drama queen.
Yep.
I mean, you know, he's just scheduling this appointment for his great magician's revelation of the magic trick.
And he says that you give me carte blanche to act. So, you know, I want to, you know, draw money to pay for this. And he says, absolutely. So just whatever you have to spend to get it back. Holmes goes back to Baker Street. We get another disguise in which he is a common loafer. How does Paget draw him as a common loafer? There he is, the common loafer. That looks like a loafer hat to me. it almost looks like a Tam O'Shanter, but it's got a bill on it because it's got some little thing off the top here. But it has this bill. So, I in using that, you know, kind of loafer term there, he's a common loafer, you know, as a loafer, he's kind of, right. He's invisible, right? He's just some guy wandering the streets, but the use of that term loafer seemed to me to be really, really class driven as well. And it got me thinking, I don't even know the etymology of loafer. And it's weird because I looked it up and it is a really obscure etymology. Like, nobody's quite sure where this word comes from. But it's probably an early 19th century word. And it is, for British readers, it's a class. And it's very judgmental. And a loafer is a person who chooses not to work. Minutes taken in a poor relief committee meeting. I can't remember the year, but it's close to this time, somewhere in the 1890s. And it said, would you retain those men in a workhouse who, though belonging no doubt to the tramp or loafer class, yet are men who are going to some part of the country where they expect to get some kind of odd jobs. So that idea that loafers are guys who aren't going to go to work and they're choosing not to. But the word might actually be American. And it winds up being used differently in America, at least by a couple authors. There's a great passage from Walt Whitman, and now I realize I forgot where this passage came from, but it goes, how do I love a loafer? Of all human beings, none equals your genuine, inbred, unvarying loafer. Now, when I say loafer, I mean loafer. Not a fellow who is lazy by fits and starts, who today will work his 12 or 14 hours and tomorrow doze and idle. I stand up for no such halfway business. Give me your calm, steady, philosophic son of indolence. And then he finishes with, all the old philosophers were loafers. And there's another author that we know Doyle has read that Sherlock quotes, Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. We did the trout and the milk quote in Noble Bachelor. This actually, and this is why I think it's interesting, because there's a Thoreau quote that it says, if a man walk in the woods for love of them, half of each day, he is in danger of being regarded as a loafer. But if he spends his whole day as a speculator, shearing off those woods and making earth bald before her time, he is esteemed an industrious and enterprising citizen. So both Whitman and Thoreau are like, hey, loafing isn't so bad if it depends on the reason why you're doing it. And Doyle's been reading Thoreau because he quotes Trout in the Milk, and maybe that's where he got the loafer quote here, as the loafer term. The word stuck in his head, maybe. I don't know. But in any case, it's a class judgment. This is a class thing. This is a guy who Holmes can dress like this guy and not be noticed, because there's all kinds of guys out there like that. So they say. So sorry, little. I just, you know, I.
No,
you
know. that was a delightful tangent.
I love these things, and I think I've done too few of them for this show.
Yeah, I mean, it's always delightful to see Holmes dressing up. You've got to wonder what his closet looks like, and just imagine this kind of ginormous Carrie Bradshaw style closet, except full of disguises. But it's so interesting to see that he is always dressing up as somebody lower class, because that's the people you don't look at. That's the people you don't pay attention to.
Yeah. And so this is what his disguise, so we can go and find out, he's following footprints and finding out where, you know, this all led to. But before he goes, he cuts a slice of beef from the joint upon the sideboard, sandwich it between two rounds of bread, and put it in his pocket. Pocket sandwich! I love that he's got a pocket sandwich.
Oh, yeah, I know. I noticed that. I had some questions about that one.
So, you'd hope that he'd put it in paper or something, but nah, well, my pocket's clean. Stick it in your pocket. So,
I mean, wouldn't it just, you know, fall apart, but... Okay.
I am the kind of person who will occasionally have food in my pockets, and I just pull out food from my pockets and eat them. I have no, you know, I'm a common loafer is what I am. So I love a pocket sandwich. Anyway, he goes out, he comes back, and when he comes back now, he's all happy. His eyes twinkle. And Watson says that it's no uncommon thing for him to be away for days and nights on end when he was hot upon a scent. Another thing I'm thinking, like, oh, I love that he used that phrase, hot upon a scent. I looked it up, and it's like, it's clearly, it goes back to the Middle Ages, you know, but for this, it's interesting, because Holmes as a detective is a hunter in the city. And it's a rural expression for people, you know, for hunters out in the, you know, in rural areas hunting game. And now it's being brought into an urban environment by a detective. And I think that is a change. Now we think it's a common cliche for investigators, police, and things, but this is still a new thing. This is one of the things that Doyle is doing to create this, something that will become a cliche.
Well, just like the, you know, the phrase, the game's afoot, that is, yeah, you know, one of the cliche Holmes phrases.
Holder shows up and says that, oh, now it's all really bad because Mary, his niece, has left him, and she's left alone.
I'm so shocked.
Her letter's odd. Did you have her letter there?
Yes.
Read her letter.
My dearest uncle, I feel that I have brought trouble upon you, and that if I had acted differently, this terrible misfortune might never have occurred. I cannot, with this thought in my mind, ever again be happy under your roof, and I feel that I must leave you forever. Do not worry about my future, for that is provided for, and, above all, do not search for me, for it will be fruitless labor and an ill service to me. In life or in death, I am ever your loving Mary.
Yeah, you know, if I had acted differently, yeah, if you hadn't stolen it and given it to Burnwell, none of this would have happened. But I think the letter is the kind of thing that now Doyle puts this in here, that now this once it's discovered, now Holmes reveals it, that this is the thing that can kind of bring sympathy back to her. That she has revealed that she is, you know, really hurt by this situation and now must go away. And so, you know,
is it that, or is she fleeing because she knows Holmes has figured her out
and going to get caught? Yeah. But she still hasn't confessed. And then, he says, he asks Holmes, like, where are the gems? And he's like, oh, would you pay $1,000 apiece for them? And he says, I would pay 10. And then he's like, oh, well, how about writing me out a check for £4,000? Remember that 4,000 is what he writes the check for. And then Holmes goes over, takes it out, the piece. Here it is. I have found it. You know, it's funny that when the... one of my colleagues at work read this story, and the first time he had read it, you know, and all he could think was like, oh my gosh, there's like a damaged item from a collection. Now they're going to have to get a conservator to fix it. How is the conservator going to repair this coronet? So that's the world that we live in.
I mean, it does raise some questions in that, you know, the coronet is broken. Presumably, you know, once the Prince of Wales or whoever gets it back, either he's going to get it back in two pieces or it's going to have to be fixed. Like, what is going to happen there?
Well, now he's going to need a conservator is what he's going to need, and a professional conservator to repair this. So the prince doesn't know it was ever damaged, but like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, but you know, the conservator is going to have to work fast. Yeah, I mean, you know, don't they have like 3 days?
So, and this is also like the big theatrical revelation for Holmes, right? To like, aha, where are the gems? They're right here in the drawer. And he pulls them out. I mean, he loves doing this thing.
He does it in the naval treaty, I believe. I mean, he just
later.
I reiterate, Sherlock Holmes is a drama queen.
He likes the big reveal. And this goes back to Poe's Dupin. Edgar Allan Poe's Dupin loves the big reveal at the end of a story that he does in all three of the Dupin stories. He's got a big reveal that he tells people what's going on, and he likes to do that. Holmes is just as theatrical. And but he tells Holder that he has to apologize to his son and get him out of jail because he didn't do it. And now here comes the real bad news. There is an understanding, Holmes says, which is a real, you know, understatement here, between Sir George Burnwell and your niece Mary. They have now fled together. And now this is when Holmes reveals it all. Burnwell is one of the most dangerous men in England, a ruined gambler, desperate villain, man without heart or conscience. And she, you know, and he preyed upon her, and she fell in love with him, and she became his tool in the end and stole the coronet. And Holmes, you know, and also it's interesting that she has. If she has run away with him, she is already now probably slept with him. This is like the whole, like, we get back to like the whole Pride and Prejudice, Lydia Bennett, you know, when she goes away with Mickle.
She's ruined.
Yeah. And, but I, she also may have already, and this is why she felt like she had to go through with it to begin with. So this could be a situation where he has already convinced her to have sex with him, and she has done so. And now it's like, I have no choice. Now I have to go off. Like, the only way to save any measure of respectability is to leave the family and go off with him.
But I mean, I'm just sort of struck by sort of Mary and the awful position she's in, and just kind of almost the lack of compassion towards her, in the sense that, you know, a young, inexperienced woman who doesn't go much out into society, who's seduced by this kind of experienced rake, essentially. Yep. I mean, that's kind of a tale as old as time. We get that in so much literature. And it's actually tragic, because if that happens, you know, she has no recourse. She can't provide for herself. But if she loses her good name, you know, she has nothing else to live on. And there is actually another Sherlock Holmes story. I believe it's The Illustrious Client, but I'm terrible with matching up the names with the actual stories. It's one of my, you know, flaws. But it's a story in which, you know, a woman is kind of seduced by this villainous man, and Holmes's job is to kind of steal his book of kind of women he's been with, kind of blood book of names of like notches on his bedpost, to show to her, to get this woman to leave him, to essentially save her reputation. And we see none of that compassion here. We just sort of see, well, she's let herself be seduced by this rake. She's kind of the villain in this story, and we're just going to let her go off and leave her to whatever that fate is. And that fate might be, you know, Burnwell might leave her. He might leave her unmarried and ruined, and she will have no money, no position, no reputation. No one else will marry her. I mean,
yeah,
she might well end up quite literally in the poorhouse, but we don't know. And that's a thread that's just left hanging.
All Holmes says is, there are women in whom the love of a lover extinguishes all other loves. And I think that she must have been one. So on the one hand, Holmes is like saying, like, she, like, he's acknowledging that it was like because she fell in love with him. But of course, it's no good, because we know who Burnwell is, but she doesn't know who Burnwell is. She does, I mean, but she doesn't care because she's in love with him.
Well, it's that phrase, you know, the love of a lover extinguished the love of family, which should have been her first duty. So it's almost this implication that, well, if she does end up in the poorhouse, she kind of got what she deserves, because she should never have put anyone else ahead of her familial duty. But kind of in the real world and outside of that Victorian system of values, I mean, what happens to her is somewhat tragic. I mean, who of us hasn't done something stupid when we were, you know, 22, 23, 24? But for her, that will follow her for the entire rest of her life.
And who's the hero? The hero is Arthur. Arthur is the hero for not admitting that he saw her, you know, take the coronet and give it to her lover, and then he had to go and get it back from him, and then it broke. Arthur stayed silent. Arthur was going to go to jail because he wouldn't, you know, blame, you know, the person who he saw do it. And that kind of Victorian idea of the chivalrous male, he's the one who set up as the hero in this story for not exposing her.
Well, but also, if she went to prison, I mean, that would be terrible for the family's reputation, and in so many ways for the bank's reputation, for their reputation. I mean,
it's that. It's right back to the beginning of the story, right? It's you know, it's a story. The crime. It's about, the case is about public disgrace. Mm-hmm. It's really what it's about. And and here, well, We also get, actually, towards the end of the story, we get the thrill of watching Sherlock. He tells a story how he follows the footprints and all that. And that's a thrilling, you know, thing that we get to, the reader gets to watch Sherlock do. And then he also, of course, gives his great, one of his great lines here, which you know so well, you know, also from Star Trek.
When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be true.
Right. So, and when you've heard the, when you've heard it, you know, when you've heard Spock say it, then, you know, it really, you know, means even more. What movie is that? That's the Nicholas Meyer one, right? The six?
I believe so, but then it also got reprised in the kind of reboot movie that they put out in 2009, after which there was this flurry of misattributing that quote to Spock, actually. You know, people were not realizing that, that Spock actually was quoting Sherlock Holmes, so it was and this whole
It's the second
thing.
Time that, that Holmes, he also says it in Sign, I can remember. I literally used this to police a detective once, who was investigating.
Oh, I got to hear this story.
He was investigating a theft at a place that I worked, and I had thought I had pieced it together. And I literally said that, you know, well, you know, what I did is, you know, it's but I admitted what it was. I wasn't like trying to pretend. I'm sure I was like, it's a Sherlock Holmes quote, and is. When you eliminate the impossible, exclude the impossible, whatever remains is the truth. And that's what I did. And it's like, so this must be what happened. At the
Were you
end
right?
of the day, no, no, no. At the end of the day, it's we didn't have all the information. So at the end of the day, the person that stole something wasn't even in the building. It was, they stole it from somewhere else. And because, you know, but anyway, but I actually had the temerity to say that to an actual police detective when I was
that's the best thing I've heard
27,
all day.
28 years old. And I was like, well, you know, like, can't you solve this crime?
how did this detective react?
He wanted me to take a lie detector test because they thought I did it. So anyway, I knew I didn't do it because I knew I didn't do it. So I had to find out who did it.
that's delightful.
Well, Holmes knew that it had to be, you know, someone who knew, as we've said. So it was either the maids or like a servant, or it was Arthur or Mary. And, you know, and the fact that Mary kept saying, like, what was he, the maid? Boys, how about the maid? Like, that's like the big clue that it's not for Sherlock, that it's not her. And he matches the footprints for Holder and all that stuff. But then he tells this great story about how he has to, when he goes to confront Holder, or confront Burnwell and get the gems. And there's a great pageant illustration for this, and the text is that he denied everything, but then when I gave him every particular that had occurred, he tried to bluster and took down a life preserver from the wall. And if you're thinking a life preserver is, you know, something that's going to save you from drowning, a life preserver for the Victorians was this like hammer-looking thing in his hand. It's preserving your life because if someone attacks you, you can attack them.
You can beat them. Their brains out.
Beat their brains out with it. That's what they call it, a life preserver. It's just a weighted, it's like a mace, basically. It's got a weighted end and a handle. And he pulls that from the wall and Holmes the pistol to the head. This is an action shot right here, right? You know? Pistol to his head. This is Holmes, you know.
I mean, it's also so great. I mean, Holmes is just, you know, this guy is an aristocrat, and he's just pointing a pistol at his head in his own house in broad daylight. I mean, it just astounds me.
And it goes to, you know, it just goes to show how dangerous, you know, Burnwell is, that he's literally going to, you know, he's going to kill Holmes to get away with this. But then what Holmes does is negotiates to buy the gems. Holmes is like, "Oh, I'll pay you for them." And then Burnwell's like, "What? You'll give me £1,000 a piece? I already sold them for 600." So that's pretty much the only punishment for Burnwell in this, is that he could have made an extra £1,200. Holmes goes
I mean, again, it's about reputation, and it's this interesting conundrum that in order for Burnwell to be properly punished, it would all have to come out. So what is more important, the reputation of a prince of the realm or properly punishing this guy?
Yeah. Holmes found out who he sold them to, and he goes and he haggles and he gets them for $1,000 apiece. Mind you, after Holmes gets them for $1,000 apiece, for $3,000, he then comes back with the gems and the piece and gives them to Holder, and he says, "Right for $4,000." Holmes profits on this. Holmes decides, "I could use £1,000 extra to solve this because you're rich." And this is like that kind of thing, like Holmes loves to do the pro bono cases for people who have no money, because he knows people like this will pay for, you know, solving this. And England has been saved from scandal.
I mean, £4,000 for saving the crown from scandal. That's a deal for the crown.
Yeah. That's why, again, I think, like, this is the Prince of Wales. So saved England from a great public scandal. But Mary and Burnwell, like, Burnwell has literally made, what, 600 apiece, right? He's made £1,800 off of this. And you think at some point he's just dumping Mary. I mean, this is the portrait that Holmes has found out about him, that this is the kind of person that he is. Holmes says at the end, "I think that we may safely say that she is wherever George Burnwell is. It is equally certain, too, that whatever her sins are, they will soon receive a more than sufficient punishment." Yeah, she's going to get abandoned, maybe pregnant, with nothing, and Burnwell gets to walk away. There's no justice in this story.
Or, you know, even if he does, by some happenstance, marry her, you know, and then he just gambles through all their money continuously while she has kind of no say over anything.
It is more than the other stories where people weren't punished. This one is really not. Like, not only does Burnwell not get punished, but Mary is clearly worse off than she was before. So it is troubling. And I like that Doyle wrote this troubling ending here, that this isn't a perfect world.
Yeah, I hadn't read the story for a long time. So rereading this and just getting to the ending, I couldn't stop thinking about Mary in the position she ended up in.
Yeah. And this is a window on this time as well, in which, you know, for Holmes and for Holder and everybody involved here, the reputation of this family matters more than people being taken care of and criminals being punished.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sometimes at a terrible price.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's it. Thank you.
Well, Ed, I think we finished almost on time. That is quite impressive of us, actually. We did.
It's rare. Thanks, Sherlockians. Thank you for joining us for episode 15 of Sherlock Mondays. Anastasia, I am very happy that you were back for this story with me. And you will return for episode 21. We'll have a little break again before we get you back. You'll be back for episode 21, the Gloria Scott.
Is it the Gloria Scott? I'll have to check my calendar, but whatever you say, I believe you.
That's the very first ever, chronologically speaking, Sherlock Holmes mystery that he solved, right?
Exciting.
That'll be fun. Our next show, we will meet the governess Violet Hunter and the bizarre family she lives with as a governess in the Copper Beaches. It's almost as if Doyle is writing a Charlotte Bronte story or Bronte story here with Sherlock Holmes.
I think Mary is on for that one, which is perfect because she is one of the leaders of the Sons of the Copper Beaches of Philadelphia. So
Mary Alcaro will be our co-host, who is one of my fellow Copper Beach Smiths. So thank you to, as you are, thank you to our chat, Mrs. Hudson, Brianna, for managing the live chat links. Thank you to the sponsor of Sherlock Mondays, Lisa Washington. We couldn't do these shows without the generous support of our patrons. You can support the Rosenbach through donation. Your support helps us create more programs like this and also care for our collections. You could also become a member. Membership gives you early access and discounts to programs and courses. You can find out more at our website, rosenbach.org. Again, let me remind you to subscribe to this channel, to like these videos, please, to leave comments. If you're listening to the podcast, leave us a review. Thanks, Anastasia.
Thank you again for having me.
I will see you soon. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbach Museum and Library, where the game is a book. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
The Rosenbach Museum and Library thanks you for listening to Sherlock Mondays, sponsored by Lisa Washington, hosted by Edward G. Pettit, music by Pleated Gazelle.